The Guardian.
Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
There can be few scientists who can claim to have made contributions to both the understanding of Alzheimer's disease and the production of cheesy Wotsit-style crisps. In fact, there's probably just one person whose career has spanned this particular range, and that is Professor Dame Athene Donald. Working in theoretical physics in the 1980s, Donald took the then unfashionable decision to apply her physicist's mindset to the messy, complicated world of biology. She is now recognised as one of Britain's most eminent scientists, and in recent years has relentlessly used her influence to champion the cause of women working in science and to challenge gender stereotypes.
Now, clearly you have to make compromises. You know, a single crystal of copper is a beautiful thing and you know exactly everything about it and you will never be able to understand a biological system in quite the same way. But I think the attitudes have changed massively over the years and possibly more in the UK than in some countries. I suspect somewhere like Germany was ahead of us in this. And I think people get misled into, we all want to be Marie Curie. Well, no, we don't. And I don't believe I ever had a role model myself. So maybe that colours the way I think. But I think it is this belief that I belong.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
What I keep in my rucksack, yes.
Amongst her many titles and roles, which are too long to list on this podcast, Professor Dame Athene Donald is an experimental physicist, a master of Churchill College, Cambridge. Athene, you were born and raised in London, but sitting down with her in the studio recently, I wanted to know how it all began. Your interest in science was triggered.
I was very lucky in that I had a physics teacher who had a physics degree, and so often that's not the case. And I guess she was a very good teacher. But as soon as I started doing physics at school, which was about 13, I just felt that was the right thing for me to do, and there's no obvious reason why that should have been, but that's how it was.
And from school, you went on to Girton College in Cambridge to study natural sciences, and you specialised in theoretical physics. Was there something about that nerdier end of science that really appealed to you?
I was doing natural sciences because that's what you do in Cambridge. To be honest, I did theoretical physics because I hated experimental physics. I don't know if it was something about that I actually hadn't been well prepared to do experiments, or I just felt completely in a fog. So for the first 2 years when I had to do practicals, I had very little idea of why I was doing them or what I was meant to do. It was a bit of a struggle. So I chose to do theoretical physics as an escape route, I suppose.
A lot of people in science education now have this focused on real-world applications and so on. And I'm interested in whether you, someone who studied theoretical physics, whether you were bothered by that when you were studying it, or whether you just had this curiosity about the natural world and like the beauty of the subject.
Well, as I say, I did theoretical physics because I didn't want to do the practical work that would otherwise have been involved in my final year. But I'd already decided when I was still at school, I had for a while been very interested in cosmology and things like that. And I consciously decided that that was too abstract and I didn't pursue it. I didn't want to pursue it because I wanted to do stuff that was relevant. So I didn't see theoretical physics as not relevant, but I knew I always wanted to do stuff that was relevant.
This led Athene into an area known as soft matter physics.
Soft matter is what it says on the label. It is soft, squidgy stuff, which is why, although the first things I did with polymers was to do with quite hard materials, so things like crash helmets, things like that, they still, because they're polymers, tend to fall under the soft matter umbrella. But much more, it's things like shaving foam or paint or a lot of food. So it's a very broad topic, and it's to distinguish it from what used to be called condensed matter, which was much more about single crystals of copper or silicon or something.
It was during this phase of her career that Athene started to look at the mechanical properties of polymers. These are molecules that are long chains of repeated chemical units.
If you think of a Perspex ruler, it's very often got sort of little white lines in it if it's been bashed around a bit, dropped on the floor. And those are what are known as crazes. So the first piece of work I did in polymers was studying crazing, which are the precursors of cracks in polymers. But we were trying to understand the relationship between the molecular properties of different kinds of polymers with the way they form these craze structures, which are like cracks, only they have fibrillar material stretched across them. And how much you can stretch the polymers relates to their structure, how they are entangled with each other. And I always felt I had a very anthropomorphic view of the polymer chains. You can think of them as bowls of spaghetti or tangles of snakes or whatever. And I'm not sure that I had any particular model in mind, but I certainly used to think very much of how they could move past each other and what might be limiting them.
And there must have been really important practical applications for that kind of work, being able to predict the properties of a material based on what you know about their polymer structure.
Indeed. And I was still at Cornell at the time, and my professor there worked very closely with both, if I can remember, Dow Chemical and GE. So, you know, there was genuine industrial interest in trying to understand the fundamentals, not instantly to make lots of money, but just to work out why one thing should be better than another. And after I came back to Cambridge, I worked with ICI when it existed. And they were also very interested in trying to understand. They had some new classes of polymers that were on the market under the Victrex label, and they didn't perform as they expected at high temperatures. And some of the work I did was able to show why things like chain length, molecular weight and temperature and things interplayed in the failure mechanisms.
And was it through the polymer work that got you into biological physics? Because that's where you went next.
It was sort of through the mechanical properties work. This sounds so silly, but the first real project I did on a starch-related system was on a system that you could think of as being Cheesy Watts. It wasn't technically, I mean, there was no food in it and it wasn't the same company, but, there was no flavour in it. But it was trying to understand the mechanical properties, because if you make what one might call an extruded foam from a starch-based material, you don't want to break your teeth on it if you're going to eat it. And so the interplay there between the processing conditions, the failure mechanisms as you chomp on it, and the underlying structure, that was what we were trying to get at. So it was a sort of mechanical properties thing. Oh, you've looked at crash helmets, why don't you look at Cheesy Watts? You know, it sounds rather absurd, but the same principles apply. And it was from that that I started thinking, well, I don't understand what happens when you stick starch in an extruder. And I started reading the literature. And for a physicist, there wasn't much that I found very satisfying. There was lots of stuff from a real biological context or a chemistry perspective, but not from a physicist perspective. And so that was why I fell into looking at these more biological materials.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said when you went to look through the literature, there wasn't that much that could help you understand this area. Was it the case at that time people hadn't really started applying physics methods to those really complicated biological systems that exist?
Yes, I think so. As I say, I think some physicists thought then, and they probably wouldn't say so now, that these biological materials were too complicated, that they couldn't be addressed. And I suppose, you know, it's one of these things that complexity has become in itself a fashionable area. So it's no longer a no-no for a physicist to try and tackle these things. Now, clearly, you have to make compromises. You know, a single crystal of copper is a beautiful thing and you know exactly everything about it, and you will never be able to understand a biological system in quite the same way. But I think the attitudes have changed massively over the years, and possibly more in the UK than in some countries. I suspect somewhere like Germany was ahead of us in this.
And when you went into it, was it just that you thought, oh, I want to solve this problem? I mean, did it ever cross your mind that it's an unusual thing to take on?
Because my colleagues were telling me. So I was under no illusions. But so I mentioned Sir Brian Pippard, who was the Cavendish professor when I first went back to the Cavendish. And he was succeeded by Sir Sam Edwards, who, if you like, was one of the fathers of soft matter and was immensely supportive. And, you know, his attitude was physics is what physicists do, and just don't take any notice of you know, people who carp at this. And, you know, he used to go around talking about the work I did on starch. And I remember going with him at one point to Nestlé in Lausanne. You know, he was very pro this kind of thing. So, and indeed, actually, to be honest, he was the one who started me off at all, because he'd instigated a sort of large programme on food physics with what was the predecessor of the predecessor of BBSRC. So that he had been driving this, and I was the experimentalist. He was a theorist. I was the experimentalist who was going to take this programme forward. So it was an odd thing to do. I was always aware of it. And if I went, say, to polymer physics conferences with my students, we were always somewhere out on the fringe because no one else was really interested. And I find it quite interesting. There was one particular conference which ran every 2 years about polymer physics in the UK. And time was when we were right on the fringe. And now, last time I went, biological physics was sort of right at the heart of it, and it is a transformation.
It's now very apparent that applying physics to understanding biological systems such as starch is possible and has a whole range of practical applications.
Everyone knows what starch is, you know, what you get out of a wheat grain or something. But the way the polysaccharides pack together in each individual granule within the grain is quite complicated. And we used a technique called small angle X-ray scattering, which is used a lot by physicists, chemists. You know, it's a sort of standard technique. They're not often in a lab as opposed to at a synchrotron. And we used it to try and work out what the packing of the molecules in the granules were. And what became clear to us was that, first of all, it was quite complicated. There were different levels of structure in a kind of hierarchical way. But also that every type of starch we looked at, wheat, maize, barley, pea starch, whatever, they all had basically the same way of packing. And there was a sort of repeat periodicity of around 9 nanometers, which was also common to each of them. And it was at that point that we started talking to plant biochemists. And over the years, I had a wonderful collaboration with Alison Smith at the John Innes Centre in Norwich. And ultimately, I think she decided that it had to be a physical reason why there was this common repeat. She couldn't come up with a biological reason, but we had a lot of interesting interactions and collaboration over about 5 years, trying to work out how the kinds of things she was doing, modifying enzymes in the plants, which changed the way the starch was laid down, how that impacted on the physical properties. And then how, when you cook starch, for instance, the different levels of packing affect what happens. So if you make custard, cornstarch, white sauce, whatever, then as you heat the granule up, the granule swells, the water goes in, and ultimately the granules disintegrate completely. So trying to understand how changes in the starches affect that is quite important.
So Athena, is it fair to say that your work has implications for both sides, for both how to make the starch, how to grow it in plants, and also the things that it can be used in?
I think so. It's certainly one of the most pleasing moments in my career was when I discovered that the model we developed for the starch granule was being taught to second year plant scientists in Cambridge as part of their degree course. And I thought, gosh, this has really made its way into understanding at a fundamental level for a biologist. And I was very pleased about that. I don't know if it's still taught. I mean, to be honest, I haven't worked in this area for a number of years, and I don't know, maybe all my ideas have been superseded.
And after this short break, we'll hear where Athene's career went next.
But this misfolding of proteins is actually in itself a really large area, much studied both by chemists and biochemists. It's not been the emphasis of what we are doing, but it sort of underpins it, because you are trying to understand why the protein, once it has unfolded, is able to stick together in particular ways to give particular structures.
We'll also hear about her role as an advocate for women in science.
And so it is much easier for me at my level to point out what have been termed micro inequities or the way committees do or don't operate well and all that kind of thing than it is for the early stroke mid-career woman to say, I'm not being treated right, because that is always, it's very difficult to do for yourself.
We'll be right back.
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin.
And then about your science. And then I wanted to ask about, quite obviously, about women in science.
No, surely not.
Specialist subject. But
before the break, we heard from Professor Dame Athene Donald on her pioneering work in biological physics, including research on starch, crash helmets, and of course the science of cheesy Watsits.
Bloody
teams
about role models and stuff. And then, yeah.
More recently, Athene has applied her expertise to another kind of polymer, protein, and more specifically, the mechanisms of how they fold.
Again, it came from the food arena. We were studying the aggregation of milk proteins as might be relevant to things like yogurt and cheese. And in particular, we were using it as a sort of model system to try and develop a new kind of microscopy, which allowed us to keep samples wet, which you can't do in a standard electron microscope where you always work in a vacuum. And we started looking at the nature of aggregates under different conditions. Now, if you heat a protein, something like beta-lactoglobulin, which is the milk protein we were studying, the protein moves from its native state in which it's carefully coiled up, folded into certain patterns. It starts to unfold, so it becomes a polymeric molecule. It's long chains. But the chains can then stick together, and they may misfold. And that gives rise to particular kinds of aggregates, which is what we were looking at. But this misfolding of proteins is actually in itself a really large area, much studied both by chemists and biochemists. It's not been the emphasis of what we are doing, but it sort of underpins it, because you are trying to understand why the protein, once it has unfolded, is able to stick together in particular ways to give particular structures.
This whole area of trying to understand how protein will behave given its structure and the conditions that it's under, it's a huge problem that people are working on in biology, bringing in, you know, bits of physics and computer modelling to try and understand it. Could you just talk a little bit about why people are so keen to crack this problem?
Very largely because it appears to underlie a lot of the neurodegenerative diseases of old age. So diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are associated with aggregates forming, for instance, in the brain in the case of Alzheimer's, and obviously leading to huge health issues. So if there was any way of understanding why the protein misfolding, which gives rise to these aggregates, occurs, or what you could do to intervene and stop it, it would be a massive, massive step forward for healthy aging. I think at the moment, it's not absolutely clear what the key proteins involved are and all the rest of it. So it's still a very large area. And you can think, people are working with fly models, for instance. Is that actually a good model for a human brain? And I am absolutely not the right person to answer those kinds of questions. But the kinds of things we were doing, what I suppose surprised us, looking at these food-based systems, was you actually saw some of the same structures as are seen in sort of post-mortem slices of tissue from an Alzheimer's patient. So although I don't think there's any implication of our work for the disease itself, nevertheless, it is clear that the behaviour of the proteins is quite generic. But the structures we see are almost certainly forming long after the toxicity has occurred in the human brain.
And is it the case that it's important for studying genetic illnesses as well? I've heard things about the way proteins fold up can affect which genes essentially end up next to each other in a in a protein.
Yes, and I think also, I was thinking you're going to ask that the other way around, that there are certain kinds of diseases which are strongly genetic, where there are clearly mutations in the protein which cause large-scale deposits of these things called amyloids in the body, because the protein does not fold in the way it does in the rest of the human population. So there are strong links. And I think everyone who's working in this area from the more biological point of view is trying to understand how the different bits of the puzzle fit together.
During the past decade, Athene has used her platform as one of the country's most distinguished academics to voice concerns about gender inequality in science, both as gender equality champion at Cambridge University and through her personal blog. But were these sentiments there from the start of her career?
I think early on in my career, I just wanted to get on with doing whatever needed doing. I couldn't help noticing that as a female physicist, there were very few of us around. And when I was in the States as a postdoc, I was in an engineering faculty and I was the first female postdoc in my department. And you couldn't help but notice that. And then as I moved up, I was first female professor in any of the physical sciences in Cambridge. But I think it was when I became much more conscious mid-career that being a woman perhaps made people uncomfortable with me, my colleagues, and that it was the standard thing of turning up at a committee and not being taken seriously and that kind of thing that I think so many women experience, which I thought was worse mid-career. I was an FRS and yet I felt I was not taken seriously. And I got, I suppose, honestly, angry about some of this. And that was when I took on the role as director of the Women in Science, Engineering and Technology Initiative in Cambridge, which was a sort of unofficial group within the university, which nevertheless enabled me to talk to people like the PVCs. And out of that, I became the university's gender equality champion. And that gave me a very clear way of starting to influence, not just about science, though that was probably where I put my emphasis, but to try and influence university policy to talk to people about things like the gender pay gap, what we are doing for women returners, those kind of things. And so it enabled me to start the dialogue in Cambridge. And when our current Vice Chancellor, I think of him as Boris Soleshek, Borisevich, came along, he was absolutely clear this was something he wanted to tackle. So there's been a following wind throughout. But I guess it grew out of anger. And I think that's how a lot of people sort of get motivated to do this.
Did you always speak out about it? I mean, I know we obviously hear from you now publicly because you're, you know, been so successful and you're a dame and your position at Cambridge. But is it something that you've always spoken out about, or did you wait until you reached a certain stature before doing that?
Well, certainly early in my career, I think like many another woman, I just wanted to get on with things. So no, I didn't speak out about it. I mean, there's this interesting thing. If you are unpersuasive at a committee, is it because you're just useless at it, or is it because you're a woman? And you never know the answer to that. And I think for many years, I probably assumed it was me. And one of the things that changed my attitude was an American professor drew to my attention the 1999 report about MIT, where they had shown that every woman on their own thought they had a smaller amount of lab space because they just weren't very good at negotiating or whatever. And when you looked across the board, you realised they were all in the same position. And I suddenly thought, maybe it isn't me. Maybe there is something more systematic going on. But you never know the answer. Maybe I was just rubbish at doing what I was trying to do. You can't tell.
Yeah, I guess that's what makes it really difficult to advocate for yourself rather than advocating for women in general, and especially women who are coming up behind you in your career.
Yes, and so it is much easier for me at my level to point out what have been termed micro inequities, or the way committees do or don't operate well and all that kind of thing, than it is for the early stroke mid-career woman to say, I'm not being treated right, because that is always, it's very difficult to do for yourself. And it's certainly something I feel very strongly that I am in this position now where I can speak out. And I do not expect to lose my job because I've been rude about my supervisor, for instance, or to fail to get a reference. And one of the things I think is most sad is those, you know, really early career PhD students or postdocs who fall out with their supervisor, perhaps because their supervisor is behaving totally improperly. And yet there is no way they can complain because they need that letter of reference. And that, I think, is terrible. And it's, you know, everyone who observes improper behaviour should speak out in support of the victim because the victim herself cannot do anything. And it, I mean, that's not just true about women, it's true about race, you know, disability or whatever. It's a generic problem and we all have a duty to speak up.
This topic is something that you've thought and written about extensively on your blog. You mentioned micro inequities and also that MIT study about women just having a slightly smaller office space and lab space and so on. Is it your view that that tends to be the problem, that it's a build-up of lots of small inequalities, or do you think there are still big kind of structural problems with women?
I think there are fewer structural problems, and I think for a lot of women it is the build-up of many small things. But as I say, there is undoubtedly still harassment going on, and that does drive women out. And even if it's not harassment against them, they may feel this is not a culture I want to be part of. I think sometimes we reward the wrong kind of behaviour, which is also something that is quite hard to quantify, but I think it sometimes makes a working environment unpalatable, and not just to women, but to men who don't share those same attributes. I mean things like believing that what matters is how many PhD students you have, not how well you look after them, for instance. I think that's one common thing, that, you know, how much granting you have is what matters, not are your students well supported. And it's that kind of thing, which I think of it by shorthand as the mind's bigger sort of way of doing science. And we do tend to reward large grant income rather than your students going on to successful careers in whatever sphere. So I think those kind of things do still go on. I think there is much more awareness of we need to have a better balanced by gender makeup of committees appointing people and things like that. But the downside of that, as any senior woman would tell you, is you get stuck on an immense number of committees. So you get stuck on all these committees and you are not then being productive. You are not doing what you're employed to do in a certain sense. And so there's a sort of catch-22, and I really don't know the answer to that. And I'm frequently asked and I don't know the answer.
People often talk about the importance of female role models in science, and Athene would probably be held up as someone who fits the bill. But her own views on this subject are more ambivalent.
I'm not convinced that, I mean, the evidence about role models influencing anyone is not very strong, in fact. I think what matters is the idea that you see someone just that bit ahead of you to make you think, yes, you know, I would fit in this organisation or whatever. I think that's important. I think there's also, there's been a lot about, does it matter if you have all women panels? Should you have all women prizes? All these things. And I do think it matters if you have all men panels. I think that, again, makes any young PhD student in the audience or whatever think there is no place for me in this organisation, in this branch of science. When it comes to women's prizes, I'm probably biased because I think a lot of my visibility came probably when I won the 2009 L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science Laureate for Europe prize. I think that's when The Guardian interviewed me and, you know, full page spread kind of thing. And I think that just gives an opportunity for whoever, the media, the world, whatever, to notice that there are women doing fantastic things. And it isn't just the same old stale white males, if I can put it crudely, that there are women out there. If we did a better job of having gender balance in everything, and if there was a better gender balance in the physical sciences, it wouldn't be so important. But as things are, I think it still does matter. Now, does that contradict what I just said about role models not being important? I'm not sure. I think it's just keeping the idea that women belong in focus. And I think as soon as you end up with all invited speakers being male or something, you've lost that, and you therefore are in danger of losing the young female community.
So I guess you're saying that it's not necessarily one specific person that you can look up to and think, I want to be you. It's more a feeling that the discipline as a whole has a place for someone like you.
I think that's exactly right. And I think people get misled into, we all want to be Marie Curie. Well, no, we don't. And I don't believe I ever had a role model myself. So maybe that colours the way I think. But I think it is this belief that I belong. I think that's the crucial thing, that I belong. And if I stay doing this, it is possible I will succeed. Not that there is no way I can succeed because there's no one who's done it before.
Special thanks this week to Athene Donald. If you're interested in finding out more about what you can do to counter gender inequality, we'll include a link to Athene's wonderful blog in this episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.